It's past one.
Welcome to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. This hour, a check on Metro News, and later in the hour, we'll look at the markets and the latest technology updates. But first, we'll keep it local. Joining us are WFPL's political editor, Philip M. Bailey, environment reporter, Erica Peterson, and general assignment reporter, Dalton Main. Thanks for being here, guys.
Hey, hey.
Hey.
All right, so we'll start. Erica, we just heard a little bit in the newscast, too. This new alert system for Rubbertown. There was a meeting last night. They were talking about what they're going to do to keep residents aware of any disasters that may be happening or emergencies.
Yeah, exactly. About 50 people showed up for the meeting. Mayor Greg Fisher was there with some people from his staff. And what he basically talked about was the city's process for getting this alert system. They got about 11 bids, and they've narrowed that down to 4. So they were kind of describing what they were looking for in these systems.
And we should say this call for an alert system came after people were unhappy with what happened in the explosion in March.
Exactly. There's a lot of confusion after the explosion. Some people were told to stay in their homes. Some were told to evacuate. And kind of nobody knew what they were actually supposed to do. So this is an effort to send one message to people through lots of different communication mechanisms to let people know what they should be doing in an emergency.
And it's down to 4 now?
It's down to 4. Fisher talked about how all pretty much had the city's basic criteria, which were they want automatic blasts to go out to, cell phones, text messages, pagers, email addresses, things like that. They also, need to still maintain a toll-free call-in number for people to actually take the initiative to call, but they also want something to reach out to people at the same time.
And, Philip, you'd covered some of the unhappiness with this, the Rubbertown hotline.
Yeah, if you go back, residents in the Rubbertown neighborhood have been upset about the lack of emergency services notices in that community for some time. And as Erica's report pointed out earlier, Ebony Cochran from REACT, the question when it happened in March, the explosion at Carbide, residents didn't know what to do. They didn't know whether that was a signal to stay in their homes or to evacuate because, when you have these chemical explosions or these issues with chemical plants in Rubbertown, residents are often confused about, is that a notice saying that I should not leave my house because there are some hazardous materials? Or should I leave because that materials are so hazardous that they could affect me even within my home? So I think she pointed out an interesting caveat to the notification system that we hadn't heard before, but you had heard at the grassroots level for a number of years.
Well, and the two main concerns that were raised at the meeting yesterday, one was Ebony's concern that if you hear a siren, there's an emergency, but you don't necessarily know what to do about it. So she was hoping that the alert system would contain something, like instead of just a siren going off, you would hear evacuate, evacuate, evacuate. It would actually give instructions. And she was told that no, none of the systems have that capability. Another concern was somebody raised the concern that they had narrowed the bidders down to 4 with pretty much no impact from community members or anyone involved, who will actually be affected by this alert system.
Who is doing the narrowing?
Mayor Fisher and his staff. It seemed to be, but that was received a little bit better than Ebony's suggestion. And Mayor Fisher said he will try to schedule some demonstrations of the system so people can see if they're actually as user-friendly as the companies think they are sometime over the next 2 weeks.
But it's looking like it's going to be some sort of system where there will be a siren. People will get calls or text messages or pages, but they'll also be able to, if they hear a siren, call a number and find out what's going on.
Exactly. It'll be they'll call a number, they'll go online, and they'll get further instructions that way.
Okay. And when do they hope to have this in place?
By mid-August, but it'll take about, about 4 or so weeks after they decide on whoever's going to implement the system to actually get it working and in place.
And Mayor Fisher's office is doing that. We've heard a lot about Mayor Fisher. We've heard a lot from Mayor Fisher this week on the air. Philip, you were you've reported on a few highlights from his appearance on this hour, Wednesday.
Yeah, Mayor Fisher talked about, you talked to him about a number of things, Gabe.
I was there, yeah.
You were there. Mainly about the issues with the budget, the controversy surrounding Councilwoman Judy Green, and some of the other issues he's faced early on in his administration. One of the things that was interesting in your conversation was maybe a confusion on the mayor's part during the conversation about arts funding compared to public safety funding and how much public safety funding actually is.
Do we? Oh, okay. There was a clip to play there, but it was the mayor saying, I had asked him, he's been saying that these arts, that arts groups, oh, okay, we have the clip. But given what arts groups receive and given what other parts of the budget have, you know, to compare, I think it's like $500,000 or so goes just to arts groups. And what is it, $400 million goes to public safety? Can you really compare those and say you'd rather cut this very, very small amount versus this amount that's hundreds of times larger?
Yeah, public safety is more in the neighborhood of $150 million. Regardless, it is a significantly larger multiple.
And Philip, that's not exactly right.
Well, public safety, the entire public safety apparatus funding is about $303 million. The mayor's proposed budget that I reviewed actually says, I think, about $330 million. What Chris Pointer, the spokesperson for the mayor, says is that the mayor was talking about public protection. That in the city's view is different than the entire public safety funding, which would include fire, police, EMS. That the mayor was answering your question and only talking about public protection, which is only, in his view, EMS, fire, and does not include the police department's budget. Police funding by itself is about $150, $175 million by itself. And then you include the other public safety, public emergency services, EMS, youth detentions, corrections. That's $150 million by itself. But combined to about $300 million.
But these are generally grouped together, though.
Generally, I mean, if you talk to, you know, the previous administration, members of the media, members of the public, council members, when they say the term public safety, they mean the entire apparatus of emergency services and public protection for the city of Louisville, including police, fire, metro corrections, youth detention, things like that. It was really just, I think, a misstatement on the mayor's part. And, you know, being in government, a lot of the jargon gets confused, but I think a lot of callers and listeners are wondering, how is the city only paying $150 million for public safety when it takes up 60% of the budget? So to clarify that, I think it's pretty clear that the entire public safety apparatus is over $300 million.
And also on that show, the mayor had talked a little bit about the ethics hearing for Councilwoman Judy Green. A verdict is expected in about an hour, right?
Yeah, today at 2 p.m., the Ethics Commission will have its final deliberation on the first ethics charge against Councilwoman Green. That first charge was brought by Ray Barker Sr., a former political opponent of the Councilwoman's. It has the allegations of nepotism and that she used a city-funded program to benefit members of her family in what was dubbed the Green Clean Team. The Ethics Commission will meet. They will probably go into a closed session to deliberate on the findings of fact that were forwarded to them from the hearing officer. And they will open the meeting back up and have that vote. The seven members will have that vote publicly. There are a number of things that could happen to Councilwoman Green as a result. It could be found that she did absolutely nothing wrong, that she's innocent of these charges. It could be found that this was an unintentional violation, which could, I think the highest thing for that is maybe a public reprimand. The intentional violation, however, you would get into issues of either a fine, a public letter of censure, or recommendation for removal of office, which the council would then move on. Any of those things could happen today. What was surprising in your interview with Mayor Fisher is that he said that he had only paid attention to this issue at the headline level, maybe showing that his policy or his approach to government is much more hands-off, much more in the idea of the CEO, where other people are in charge of these things. He has a human resources director who handles most of that and handled a lot of the press releases and things around the councilwoman's charges. So it was surprising to some observers for him to say that he had only paid attention to this issue at the headline level, considering mm-hmm. these are some pretty serious allegations against a sitting member of the Metro Council.
Right, and these charges all surround council spending, and there's been a lot of debate about how council members should use these discretionary funds they get, whether they should get those funds at all, and you covered a debate on that on Wednesday.
Yeah, there were four members of the Metro Council, including who met at a debate hosted by the Louisville Forum down at Vincenzo's in downtown. Council President Jim King, Democratic Councilman David James, Republican Councilman Ken Fleming and Jerry Miller, they had a debate basically on these different accounts and how they're used. To give people a basic explanation, council members have three very important accounts. There's the $30,000 that they have in their office accounts that has a very little oversight to it, but they can use it for supplies. They often can use it to transfer money to pay their legislative aides more than the $58,000 they're given for the aides. And that money is really, truly, truly the discretionary money in the sense that there's no real oversight to it. Then there are the other two accounts, the Neighborhood Development Funds, which are $75,000, which supposedly go to nonprofit groups. And for, you know, this very vague idea of public improvement or improvements in the community or helping out the community. Then there's the largest pot, which is the $100,000 for the capital infrastructure funds, which is supposed to go to building projects, things like public works, fixing sidewalks, roads. Council Democrats and Republicans have had this debate for a number of years, and it's come to light, particularly in regards to Councilwoman Green's charges, where Council Republicans feel that these funds, particularly the Neighborhood Development Fund, should be either cut altogether or have some serious oversight and clarification on what they can and cannot be used for. Council Democrats argue that Neighborhood Development Funds go to improving the quality of life in the community. Councilman David James, for instance, used about $10,000 of his NDF funds recently to pay for overtime for police officers for a crime initiative in the Old Louisville neighborhood in his district. Councilwoman Mary Woolridge, for example, used some of her discretionary funds to pay for pool IDs for kids who want to, you know, be at some of the city pools in the remaining of the year or for the summer. Council Republicans feel that there needs to be tighter restrictions, however, on those funds, particularly in light of what's happened going on with District 1 and Councilwoman Green.
And we'll be following the debate on what should happen with these council funds, and as well as the Judy Green hearing. You'll be hearing about that this afternoon. Another big story that's happening this week in Louisville and in Lexington, two districts both, searching for a new superintendent for public schools. Here at Jefferson County Public Schools, there are two finalists now for the position. And Dalton, you went to these public forums with both of them earlier this week.
Mm-hmm. Monday and Wednesday evening at Male High School, they hosted public forums with, the first was Dr. Christine Johns-Haynes, and the second was Dr. Donna Hargens. At each forum, the public was open, you know, was able to come show up. They could sit, they could, you know, give questions to moderators who would then ask the questions of the candidates. And there was a diverse array of questions there, but there weren't that many people there. Only a little over 150 is what I counted at each one. And given the size of the auditorium, it really felt and looked sparse, the crowd at each one, and it seemed sort of empty. So, you know, each candidate got a wide variety of questions nonetheless, but neither one seemed to have a lot of answers. And that was something that has been addressed in the media all this week. A lot of people have been commenting on the fact that they are unsatisfied with, you know, both the candidates, essentially. And it culminated with the NAACP yesterday calling for JCPS to reopen the search because they say that neither of these candidates is ultimately qualified to handle the specific issues facing our districts, the largest of which is probably the student assignment plan and busing. And a little bit of background on them. Dr. Christine Johns-Haynes is superintendent of Utica Community Schools, which is a relatively small suburb of Detroit. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit north of there. And Dr. Donna Hargens is the chief academic officer for Wake County Public Schools, which is Raleigh, North Carolina. And it's a very large district. It's the nation's 18th largest district. It's got about 143,000 students. And that's what she touted, you know, at her appearance.
And a student assignment plan as well.
And they did. They had a controversial student assignment plan, which she presided over as interim superintendent last year while they searched for a new one. And she, I do not think she was considered for superintendent when they did their search. She was simply interim, and she presided over this controversy, which included a riot at a school board meeting, at which I believe about 19 people were arrested. Yet, when asked about the new student assignment plan and how that's been resolved, she didn't really have an answer. And that's been a major point of criticism from everyone, is that she presided over this controversy, yet doesn't seem to know anything about it.
The reason for that is, didn't local observers here gave up? The part of the problem was that when the same thing was going on with Jefferson County and the student assignment plan, when it went to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. Wayne County was sort of the mirror to that, where right. They changed their student assignment plan. And many people thought that she would be the lead candidate, considering that she was there in Wayne County at the time.
Wayne County.
And because of that, I think that's why a lot of people may be sort of underwhelmed with both of these candidates, considering.
Yeah, she was asked about the specific options for the plan, and there were two. I think there was I don't remember if they were colors. I don't know. They had some sort of code word for each plan. And she said, well, both of those were, you know, proposed by the new superintendent, and he presided over that, and I'm not familiar with them, which was sort of odd.
So I get the sense that people were going to these meetings wanting some answers, especially from the latter candidate, some substantive answers on the issues that are important to them, some of the issues that current Superintendent Sheldon Berman was really criticized on, and they just didn't get those.
Mm-hmm. They asked a lot of great specific questions and brought up specific issues, and that was essentially what these forums sounded like they were designed to do, was to let people ask specific questions and see, you know, where do these candidates come into play on these issues. And both candidates sort of gave answers that would say, you know, well, I look forward to seeing the details on this, and I will review all the information, and, you know, then I'll have an opinion, which...
And what's the possibility that they could reopen this search?
I don't know. Steve Imhoff, when I talked to him about it, said he personally does not want to reopen the search. But, you know, he couldn't comment for how the school board is going to act. And he, you know, didn't give me any sort of possibilities as to what they could do. But they are meeting. He said they're going to meet on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, to discuss the candidates. And, you know, he had said that that was going to be where they set a timeline for making a decision. But I guess now it's possible for them to discuss the reopening of it. But I wouldn't be able to say either way because he didn't give me any information on that.
All right. And we'll be watching for any updates as they come. And we'll be covering that meeting next week. And this brings us to our first break. We'll have more Metro news and we'll look at what's going on in Indiana in just a minute. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. And good afternoon. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. With us today from the newsroom are Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Dalton Main. And now joining us from the Indianapolis Star, Heather Gillers. Heather, hello.
Hi.
Hi. We'll start talking with you. The Planned Parenthood case, this Indiana law that strips Planned Parenthood of its Medicaid funding, there was a hearing on that Monday, a challenge to that law.
That's right. It's being challenged in federal court by Planned Parenthood. The organization is saying that the law violates both federal Medicaid policy, which has some rules about what kinds of limits states can put on where Medicaid clients receive health services. And Planned Parenthood is also saying that the law violates the Constitution for two reasons. First, they say that providing a constitutionally protected service, i.e. abortion, that it would be unconstitutional for the state to punish Planned Parenthood for doing that. And then they say that another part of the law, which requires doctors to make certain statements to patients, such as fetuses can feel pain at 20 weeks or less and life begins at conception, they say that forcing doctors to say those things to patients violates doctors' free speech rights.
And we should explain this law. It was signed earlier this year, passed by the General Assembly, signed by Governor Mitch Daniels, and it blocks state or federal, blocks public money from going to any organization that provides abortions, correct?
That's exactly right.
And already, though, there, and Planned Parenthood is arguing this, there is already a restriction on federal money being used for abortions.
That's right. That's right. That's a very important part of this. It's called the Hyde Amendment. There is a federal law that says no taxpayer money can be used for abortions for exactly the reason that Indiana wants further restriction, because the idea is that people who find abortion to be an odious practice shouldn't have to have their tax dollars go to pay for it. Now, Indiana wants to take it a step further and say people who oppose abortion also should not have to have their tax dollars go to an organization that provides abortion, even though the money isn't directly paying for the procedure. And that's where the fight started.
And so what is the state's defense in this case?
Well, they have responses to each of Planned Parenthood's allegations. First of all, they say that Medicaid is more of a contract between the state and the federal government, and it's really up to the state to decide what the rules are for who gets Medicaid. On the constitutional issue, they say that while a woman may have a constitutional right to an abortion, a doctor doesn't have a constitutional right to perform an abortion. And on the doctor free speech issue, they say that while doctors are required to make these statements, they can also qualify them and add their own advice to each individual patient.
And the ACLU is involved in this case. What's their response to that argument?
That's right. They're representing Planned Parenthood in court. And they say basically that, no, the federal government gives you your Medicaid money, so it makes the rules. It holds the purse strings, so it's the boss, basically. And they say that forcing doctors to make statements that they may believe are misleading is violates doctors' right to free speech in the same way that you can't stop someone from saying something, you also can't make someone say something. That's the ACLU's argument. And they say that doctors do have a constitutional protection as far as providing abortions.
And the federal government has gotten involved in this as well.
That's right. This is a battle that's being fought on two fronts. And last week, the federal government sent Indiana's Medicaid office a letter saying that it violates federal Medicaid policy to cut off Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood. The policy that violates basically says that the federal government says that violates is basically a rule that says Medicaid clients should be able to get services wherever they want to as long as the doctor is qualified.
And so
now, Indiana says that it should be able to set the rule.
And so how is that going to play out? What are the possibilities there?
Well, that's a great question. Probably the court decision would come before the decision from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, which is a federal agency that is right now telling Indiana they can't do this. Judge Tanya Walton Pratt in federal court in Indianapolis has said she's going to rule before July 1st. Usually the federal government takes a lot longer than that.
And so what could happen here? The judge could block the law, but can the state rethink this without another vote from the General Assembly?
That's also a great question. And one of the possibilities that's been floated in court, that was floated in court on Monday by Solicitor General Thomas Fisher, was an idea that's been used in Texas, actually, which is to have Planned Parenthood spin off its abortion provider into a separate entity, and there would be it would be a separate corporate entity, so there would be sort of an even higher and thicker wall between Planned Parenthood's other services that they provide to Medicaid patients, such as cancer screens and birth control and sexually transmitted disease tests, and then their, on the other hand, their abortion provider.
And where is the governor on all this? Mitch Daniels, when he signed this law, was criticized. People were saying this was essentially his attempt to paint himself as being socially conservative if he were gearing up for a 2012 presidential run. But now that he's not running, where is he? What's he doing with all this?
Well, he said he'll honor the court's decision. He hasn't said anything about the federal government's decision, but he said he'll honor the judge's decision.
And he hasn't weighed in any other way on that?
No. It's interesting because one of the big questions about the federal government here is, what are they going to do if we don't listen to them? And they could do anything from taking away our $4 million in Medicaid family planning money to taking away our more than $4 billion, with a B, dollars in Medicaid money total. Now, that would be devastating and probably wouldn't make anyone look good. But Daniels has said that if the stakes are losing $4 million, that might be something that we could handle.
And so a ruling in this case in the challenge in federal court, that's expected by the end of the month, right?
That's right.
All right.
Not in the case itself, but in as far as whether Planned Parenthood is going to be funded while Judge Tanya Walton Pratt is hearing the case, we're going to hear that by July 1st, and that will be a really good indicator of which way she's going to rule, because she wouldn't allow funding to keep flowing to Planned Parenthood unless she thought that they have a pretty good case.
All right. Heather Gillers from the Indianapolis Star, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and turning back to our reporters here, our WFPL reporters here in the studio. Erica, you reported earlier this week on the war on coal. This is a meme that's been picking up lately with politicians on both sides.
Yeah, exactly. The past couple of weeks, we've seen Governor Steve Beshear, Senator Mitch McConnell, and State Representative Jim Gooch Jr. are the most recent politicians to kind of pick up this rhetoric. But they're all saying, you know, the EPA's actions are a war on coal, they're a war on Kentucky, and basically using that as somewhat of a political tool to gear in place for upcoming elections.
The EPA's actions in seeking to further regulate pollution from coal.
Well, that, and I mean, as Len Peters, the Secretary of the Energy and Environment Cabinet, described it, he stopped a step short of calling it a war on coal, but he described it as it's a perfect storm of everything coming together. So on one hand, you've got some regulations for coal mines. You've got the EPA scrutinizing some water permits for coal mines, which has slowed down the permitting process. Then on the other hand, you've got new rules for air emissions from power plants. So it's kind of they're looking at just so many different facets of things that use coal and include coal that it's kind of, you know, it's got everyone fired up about this issue.
And you'd reported that while some of the rhetoric calling it a war on coal, a war against Kentucky, may be a little exaggerated, the importance of coal in the state also is kind of being blown up here.
Well, I mean, coal is a very important resource to Kentucky. It's an important resource to a lot of Appalachian states, as well as to a lot of western states where they mine basically a totally different way and a different type of coal. It's not Kentucky's biggest industry. I think it's about sixth in line. It's, you know, manufacturing's bigger, retail trade, transportation, insurance. The insurance industry and financial industry is bigger than the mining industry here. But they're really painting it as kind of not only Kentucky's lifeblood, but it's very important to the state's energy mix, which ties into another story I did this week. The Energy Information Administration, which is, it's a federal effort, released a new study about coal production, and it showed that production in Appalachia did decline during this last year from 2009 to 2010. And Appalachia includes East Kentucky and their coal fields. It does not include Western Kentucky. And the interesting thing here is that production in East Kentucky declined a lot. It declined 10%, which is a pretty huge number for coal production. But in Western Kentucky, it increased by more than 13%.
And so is this the future that we're going to start seeing in mining in Kentucky? Is Eastern Kentucky, do you think, going to continue to decline while Western Kentucky picks up?
Well, I think that's what analysts are predicting. If just because Western Kentucky coal is becoming more valuable, it's easier to get to. You don't have the rugged terrain you do in East Kentucky, West Virginia, all these mountains and valleys in the way. So you can have kind of more large-scale surface mines that are slightly more similar to the pit mines they have out in Wyoming. So it's easier to get to, which means it's cheaper to mine. You can, and it's easily burned in power plants. It actually has more power, more energy than the Wyoming coal. So it's a little bit more bang for your buck if you're going to burn the coal.
And then Wyoming coal, that's a very large coal resource for the country, right?
It's huge and it's growing. The problem, though, is that it is it has a relatively low energy. So it's cheap and it's being used all over the country and it's economical to burn. But Western Kentucky coal, you've got slightly more energy and it's more expensive, but you know, it can be a better fuel in some cases.
And returning to the mention of where coal stands as an important industry in Kentucky, Philip, you can help me out on this. It doesn't seem like over the last 2 years, as we've seen some increases in federal regulation on certain industries that in Kentucky are larger than coal, changes in tariffs, things like that, that there was as much heated rhetoric from local politicians saying there's a war on Kentucky.
Yeah, an election year can do that to politicians. And I think that when you have an unpopular president in the state, I think you see the convergence of both Republicans and Democrats getting behind that. You know, the coal industry is certainly, as Erica pointed out, may not be the leading industry in the state, but it certainly is one of the more active as far as campaign contributions and throwing its weight around in these elections. And as a result of that, you see, you know, that's why you see, you know, a Democratic governor like Steve Beshear and a Republican, a powerhouse like Mitch McConnell, coming together, at least in rhetoric, around the issue of energy and coal. It's interesting, though, that the environmental groups haven't gotten as vociferous as they have in years past in response to this, simply saying that, well, we don't agree that there's a war on coal and there are other means of energy that we can be pursued. You've seen Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and others make, you know, mountaintop removal a main issue, but I don't think that it's been played out as far as the gubernatorial election, because the question would be that if you really have two candidates who are, on the scale of things, pretty much conservative when it comes to issues of coal, Steve Beshear and State Senate President David Williams, and there may not be an option. I mean, Gabriel Galbraith is certainly an independent candidate who's a perennial candidate who someone people pay attention to in the state, but I don't know if environmental groups have thrown down a gauntlet saying that we are going to not support or to support any particular candidate based on their position on coal or the environment as a whole.
And just to add to that, I think one of the reasons coal is kind of one of these issues is because, I mean, not only the money you mentioned, Philip, but it's something that really does touch everyone's life. Whether or not you live in eastern or western Kentucky, whether or not you live near a coal mine, you see things like power rates increasing. And it's something that, you know, everyone can see on their bills and that everyone likes to get excited about. And the coal industry has done a very good job in kind of connecting the dots for people and saying, well, do you want your bills to stay down? We need to get rid of these regulations on coal. And it's also an issue that, you know, it's a societal thing where coal is something that that people culturally relate to a lot in areas of the state, whether or not there's still coal mining there or not.
And Philip, you mentioned the governor's race. There was a recent poll out and already some controversy around the poll.
Yeah, CN2 Pure Politics released the first poll of the gubernatorial election, the main contenders being Democratic Governor Steve Beshear and State Senate President David Williams. And that poll shows Governor Beshear leading by 21 points with 51% of the vote to 30% by Mr. Williams. Many are already saying this indicates a blowout. The Williams campaign late last night came out with a memorandum from the campaign manager, consultant, and an advisor, essentially saying in the memorandum that the poll conducted by CN2, which was conducted by the Braun Research Group in Illinois, is inaccurate and it has a history of a bias against Republican candidates. I talked to a managing editor of Pure Politics, Ryan Alessi. He says that he stands by the poll, that it's not a predictor of the outcome of the race. It is simply a snapshot of the race at that time, and that because, you know, Governor Beshear has been running a number of ads, he's still a very popular governor in the state, and Mr. Williams certainly has high negatives. This is, according to Alessi, this isn't supposed to be what the race will be like in November. No poll, if you look at really a lot of polls, no poll is exactly accurate. The Williams campaign, however, has highlighted instances in which the Braun Research poll has, you know, had races at, you know, 20 points for a candidate who ended up losing the election. So that debate, you know, when political candidates and campaigns and politicians don't like the coverage, they certainly have the right to dispute that. But Alessi points out that the Williams campaign is not contesting the methodology of the poll. And all campaigns certainly would like to lead in every poll that's put out, but this is not going to be an actual predictor of what the results will be on election day in November.
And that's the first poll of the general election, correct?
Yes, that's the first poll that's been conducted by anyone. Survey USA and others haven't put out a poll yet. It's still pretty early in the race. We're talking about, you know, the November election, and we're not even in July yet. The race won't really probably pick up until September, October, really. But obviously, you know, campaigns are going to fight for whatever positive coverage within whatever news cycle they can get, whether they're ads or press releases or these polls that are conducted.
And another issue you'd covered this week, Philip, a change in how police handle certain crimes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that, you know, has happened on Wednesday, a new state law taken into effect that lowers certain crimes to misdemeanors where they're no longer allowed, police are no longer allowed to make those arrests. They would have citations. And for example, if someone were found with a marijuana cigarette, which is sort of a weird term that I've never heard, a marijuana cigarette, but a joint.
I think there's a lot of slang
terms for
that. A lot
of slang or joints, things like that. But Chief Robert White, police chief here in Louisville, his issue that he took with it is that it takes away tools from police officers, that it robs them of that discretion and flexibility. But certainly he's willing to follow the law, and, you know, he certainly agrees the fact that we should try to lower incarceration rates and the overpopulation of jails here in Metro Corrections. That's certainly a big issue. But the law does, in his view, take away tools from police officers. The discretion is still up to the officer. He can still make the arrest if they feel that this individual will not show up to court to follow up on the citation, or that they're a danger to themselves or to others. but it's really aimed at trying to lower some of these jail populations and reduce this, you know, certain what some people would view as unnecessary arrests for lower or pettier crimes.
And just because there isn't an arrest, though, that doesn't mean there's some sort of legalization for someone.
No, absolutely not. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it's like a traffic ticket. Just because you don't get taken to jail for a speeding ticket, but you still have to answer for it in court. This is not a legalization of marijuana in the state of Kentucky. As much as there are advocates on that side of that issue who would want that, this is simply saying that if someone is found with a marijuana cigarette of a low amount, that the officer should not arrest that person. They should just give them a citation, unless they are a threat to themselves, others, or that officer believes that that person will not show up to court.
And so there's still a wide range of discretion that an officer could have if there were any reason to bring someone in. But putting that much discretion out there, is there a danger in profiling, anything like that?
Well, anytime you leave it up to discretion, that's a vague territory. I mean, the question is that a 77-year-old, you know, white grandmother, will she go to jail for a marijuana cigarette, whereas maybe a 20-year-old teenager who's caught with one would go? That's always going to be up for dispute and up for debate, and I'm sure civil rights groups and law enforcement will continue that debate. I think Chief White's concern was that the law mandates to law enforcement that they should not make these arrests, and it's not necessarily clear when and where if they can follow those rules in certain situations, and that will certainly be followed up in the courts. But there are still misdemeanors in which, you know, there will be arrests made for torture of animals, public intoxication. I mean, those will still be arrestable offenses. But I think anytime, you know, at the margins, you have state legislators or lawmakers making changes to law and law enforcement officials by playing that out in practice at the ground level, there will always be a dispute and disagreement there on the edges.
And on disputes, disagreements, one person's word against another, Dalton, you reported earlier this week on an intellectual case of dishonesty.
That's right, Gabe. At the University of Georgia, they were set to award the Delta Prize for Global Understanding to Greg Mortensen, but they have decided to vacate the award, which means it will go to no one.
Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea.
Yes, he wrote the book Three Cups of Tea and is facing two lawsuits now. There was just another one filed this week. Two lawsuits where people have alleged that he fabricated parts of his stories and that you know, he basically duped them into donating to his charity or buying the book. And they want the purchase price back and they want their donations back. So the burden of proof is squarely on them now. They have to prove that he fabricated it. There is a lot of evidence out there. There has been a lot presented by Outside Magazine that indicates that these things might have happened. But, you know, it's still up for grabs. And the University of Louisville, who is slated to give him an award, the Grawemeyer Award for Education in September, has not made a decision regarding their award yet. But, you know, we'll see what happens. You can't use, you know, University of Georgia's decision as an indicator, but it is, you know, a major, I guess, stepping stone.
It's something that U of L is likely watching.
Yes.
All right. And that takes us to another break. Thanks for joining us, Dalton Main, Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson from the WFPL Newsroom, and Heather Gillers from the Indianapolis Star. When we come back, the latest financial and technological news. So get out your pocket calculator there, Dalton. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. And good afternoon, and welcome back to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. Joining us now is David Widener, the Wall Street columnist for MarketWatch. David, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Gabe, thanks for having me.
No problem. And I wanted to start here with something you wrote about a little bit earlier. Housing prices are back to 2002 levels.
Yeah, that's not good.
And you write that that's bad for any number of economic reasons, but then also you say that this wreaks havoc outside of the markets.
Yeah, that's true. Obviously, there's a financial impact. People feel less wealthy. Consumer spending goes down as the value of their homes goes down. They don't feel like they're earning any return on their investment. And of course, in the worst cases, people are underwater and they're paying on mortgages for home prices that don't exist anymore. So they feel like they're paying extreme premiums. But there's also a kind of societal impact, and that is people with these housing prices so low, with so few buyers in the market, people are feeling very trapped in their homes. It's making our workforce a lot less mobile, and it's kind of wreaking a kind of personal or a social impact inside the home. You know, families who are going through divorce can't, you know, often, you know, the biggest asset is the home. They sell that, divide the money. That's not happening. People are being forced to stay together. And I've talked to some psychiatrists, and you know, this whole housing situation is having a very big impact on our psyches and the way we relate to people. The pressure of lower housing prices and financial, emotional, are actually very great, and it's something that really isn't talked about very much, Gabe. So I tried to tackle that a little bit.
And also, you had written as part of that, tied in, and of course this has the psychological effects, that a lot of disposable income now, it's coming from housing, not savings, that there's more wealth tied up in housing than there has been before, and that can then have a much, much larger effect on the market.
Yeah, that's true. You know, if you look back, say, 20, 25 years ago, most of people's, if they needed more disposable income, they tapped savings. And over the last 20 years, of course, with the housing bubble, a lot of Americans went into second mortgages, home equity lines, and that's where they found their extra disposable income. And that's where we saw, you know, as the economy took off during the first part of the decade, people were going into their homes as their savings accounts. You know, they saw their price appreciation. They were watching housing prices around. Banks were very aggressive in coming at people and offering them second mortgages and credit lines based on the value of their home. And that's where they went to get their flat screen TVs, to take their trips to Europe, to, you know, fund whatever frivolity or spending that they wanted to do. And in light of that, that's created a real problem, not only in the credit cycle now as these home equity lines are being revised and people are being forced to pay down this debt. But for the banks themselves, the banks are stuck with a lot of underperforming second mortgages and people who are defaulting on those loans. And, of course, that can put a house into foreclosure. Banks don't want to do that because they're stuck right now with foreclosures. So, you know, it's a cyclical ripple effect that is not going to be resolved for a while, Gabe.
And speaking of banks, you and your colleagues disagree on what to do about bank stocks.
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, for all the reasons I mentioned, I think bank stocks are a bad buy right now. But, you know, there is a definitely a camp on the other side that says that, look, the banks have been battered. They are so low. Citigroup stock is low. Bank of America stock is low. Wells Fargo stock is low. Investment banks are stock are so low to their comparable partners in the industry and the S&P 500 that it is a good time to buy. You know, I would argue that the reason people aren't buying is because of very good reasons. You know, banks have generally led stocks in a recovery, in a market recovery, in an economic recovery. Banks are usually the first stocks to go up. It's not happening now. And I think there are a lot of good reasons why. The first is the mortgage situation that, you know, I mentioned. And just to throw one more thing in there, you know, the government is looking to get out or scale back its interest in backing the loan market. And remember that banks were originating mortgages and selling them to the government. That allowed them to put more cash into new loans. Well, that system is going to be thrown upside down because the government is getting out of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're going to scale those businesses down. So that's going to really change the banking system in the future. The second reason I would say is regulation. You know, we're already seeing how the Dodd-Frank rules passed last year, the so-called financial reform, is really tamping down profits on Wall Street. Trading revenue, which really drove profits over the last decade. You know, some of these banks made like $60 billion each, Bank of America and Citigroup, over a four-year span in the bubble. You know, that is just not going to, that kind of revenue and profitability is just not going to exist over the next 10 years if all these regulations are put into place, and banks are already acting as if they are. So I think that... You know, those two things are weighing on it. And finally, I would say that, you know, the economy itself is one reason that banks are not going to do well. And part of that is kind of this catch-22 scenario, in that you, in order to have a recovery, you need to have banks lending cash to companies who are looking to expand, hire workers, you know, and ramp up, you know, after ramping down through a recession. And the reality is that... you know, banks aren't able to do this because they have so many issues on their books, so many, you know, lingering problems from the financial crisis. So they're not lending at the rates that they used to. And so this has kind of created a cycle where the banks aren't lending, the companies aren't getting the financing, and we're, you know, people aren't getting hired. We're seeing high unemployment. And this thing is kind of snowballing. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's creating a double dip recession, but it's really causing this economy to sputter. It's one of the main reasons, I think, that the economy is sputtering today.
And David, sorry to have to jump in here. We have one more guest to get to, and we will link to your column on these on the banks and the banking stocks now. But our time's running out here, so I'll have to let you go. But thank you very much for David Widener, Wall Street columnist for Market Watch. Thanks all for being here.
Thank you.
All right, and now we'll move on. We have we'll talk with Brian Chin. He's a technology writer with Wired.com. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm good. Just a few minutes here. The big news this week, the Apple keynote. Steve Jobs, he was back. You know, the black turtleneck is making the announcements for iOS 5 for the iPhone and the iPad.
Right. So all the announcements this week were purely software related. And the big news was iCloud. iCloud is basically the component that's going to be tying together the Mac operating system with the iPhone. And what I mean by that is when you take a photo, for example, with your iPhone, it's automatically going to show up on your iPad or your Mac. And it's sending it first to that iCloud service server, which is sending it back to your other devices.
And this is a big change from the previous Apple system, Mobile Me.
Right. Mobile Me was kind of a failure. Steve Jobs even acknowledged that on stage, which is kind of funny. Mobile Me was the first attempt, or actually the fourth attempt, maybe third attempt, actually. Sorry.
There was, what, iTools, iDisk, Mobile Me, and
yeah,
now this. Yeah,
right. So they're finding, this is their fourth try, iCloud, actually. And they're taking it really seriously. They've got this gigantic data center in North Carolina to support this cloud service. Other than taking a photo, there's examples like if you edit a document on your iPhone, that same edit appears on the document on your Macintosh. And so it's pretty obvious what's going on here. They're trying to tie together these two universes for Apple, so it makes it more appealing to just have an Apple-only family of products in your house.
And there's a big step here also with iTunes, with putting music in the cloud.
Right. So they're also putting iTunes as part of iCloud. So if you buy music through iTunes, you can go on a different device, load the iTunes application, and look at the history and just download it there. So you can just share it between, I think it's 9 devices at this point.
And this is a pretty big step, given, you know, the state of putting music in the cloud like that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple's partners, the labels, were pretty strict about in the past. They wanted to not share it with that many devices. But I think over time, now that the digital music market has gotten so big and successful, they are warming up to their most successful partner, which is Apple.
And what does this mean for as far as the record industry goes? I mean, this is something that we had heard about labels fighting for some time and having this access to music to get it from all over the place. Is it different now because this is music the person owns?
I think what we're seeing is this gigantic transition into online provided media, which including music and movies, but especially in music, and Apple's always been in the lead in that front. I would expect that Amazon and Google are going to try to do something similar. They don't have the same partnerships right now because they rely on you just uploading all your music to an online locker and listening to it that way. the way that Apple is doing it is a little bit more convenient, I think, for customers.
And one other thing here, there's the Read Later feature was announced for Safari, the web browser in the next OS for desktops. You can look at an article without the ads, without all that. It just pulls the text out, essentially, from a website. This is becoming a more popular feature. There are already a few apps that do this.
Yeah, I mean, there is a really popular one called Instapaper Pro that does that already for iPhones and iPads and Macs. What Apple is doing is they're building that same functionality into the browser, which basically competes with things like Instapaper Pro. But overall, I think it's been a really good feature for especially for people reading web articles. It takes out all that junk, makes it easier to read and concentrate. And the question is, you know, is this going to tick off the publishers who have advertising running on their websites?
And yeah, there have been a few pieces I've seen already written about that. That's something also that we'll have to link to since we're running out of time here. I want to thank you, Brian Chen, technology writer with Wired.com. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Take care.
All right, and that's all the time we have. So thanks also to WFPL's Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson and Dalton Main, Heather Gillers from the Indianapolis Star, and David Widener from Market Watch. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL.